Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and now in depth on what they said and what it meant in the last presidential debate.
But we have some bad hombres here, and we're going to get them out.
Well, that's because he'd rather have a puppet as president of the United States.
No puppet. And I think the voters are seeing through it. I think they're going to see through it. We'll find out on November 8th.
He goes after their dignity, their self-worth, and I don't think there is a woman anywhere who doesn't know what that feels like.
The element of surprise. Douglas MacArthur, George Patton, spinning in their graves when they see the stupidity of our country.
There was even a time when he didn't get an Emmy for his TV program 3 years in a row, and he started tweeting that the Emmys were rigged against
him. Should have gotten it.
This hour, a discussion of the content and the context of the debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I want to hear from you, too, on this question. Given what Trump said last night about whether he'll accept the results of the election if he doesn't win, I want to know how you feel about that and this. When the election is over, can you put the bitterness and the rancor of the political discussion behind you and give the new president the benefit of the doubt? Can you accept the results? So what do you think about what Trump said about that? And how do you feel about this today? Can you accept the results? Can you give the new president the benefit of the doubt? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, nprnews.org/live. I'm on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Christina Greer is with us. She's an associate professor of political science at Fordham University and the author of Black Ethnics. And she's with us today from New York City. Christina, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Hi, good morning.
Susan McManus joins us. She's a professor at the University of South Florida, and she's with us today from Tampa. Susan, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Susan, Florida is such a key state this time around. Who is it make or break for? Is it Trump or Clinton?
Absolutely Trump. It's very difficult for any Republican to win the White House without winning Florida. And one of the reasons that Florida is such a swing state is that since 1964, only once has the state voted differently than the country at large. And we're big. We have 29 Electoral College votes. We're split, 38% registered Democrats, 36% registered Republicans, and the rest NPAs. So this is still a very competitive state, even though Hillary's moved ahead a bit.
Do you think there's, Susan, do you think there's really any undecided vote? Who are these undecided voters? Are there any left in Florida? I can't see how you'd have trouble making up your mind at this point.
Actually, there are a lot. In fact, I am the analyst for an ABC affiliate here in Tampa, and we had a focus group of 9 undecided voters come into our station last night, and they truly, truly are undecided.
Wow.
Because they're conflicted on the trustworthiness issue. And they don't trust either one of them. They're tired of the bantering back and forth, but they're very frustrated, mostly in the fact that they can't really hear either one of these candidates giving them details on how they're going to fix the economy, how they're going to deal with foreign policy, what they're going to do about immigration. Our post-debate analysis was 100% unanimous that they weren't convinced at the end of the debate, and they're still conflicted.
Oh, my gosh. Christina, what do these undecided voters want to hear, I mean, at this point?
Well, I mean, I think that's the million-dollar question. You know, sometimes we joke that they really just want attention. But I think, you know, for Republicans, many of them refuse to ever vote for Hillary Clinton but are really disgusted with Trump and some of his policies. And many Republicans right now, especially Republican women, you know, don't want to be interpreted as racist or, you know, anti-Semitic or homophobic or anti-Muslim or anti-immigrant by saying that they would vote for Trump. And so they're really torn. They don't want to sit it out, and they definitely don't want to vote for a third-party candidate. But, you know, this is sort of the first time in a very, very long time in our history where, you know, to say that you're a Republican is for some people to hear that, you know, you're saying that you're voting for a racist or an anti-Semite. So I do think that many people are confused, but I think that, you know, unfortunately, we've been very light on the issues in this election season. You know, we know that Trump speaks in platitudes and superlatives, and Hillary Clinton, you know, has had a very long career in public service, but, you know, many people find that, you know, they cannot trust her, they refuse to trust her, and she's a little too entrenched in the, you know, the larger system at large. So what they hope to hear, I mean, probably a lot more detail about the economy, jobs, and also our place as a world leader in international affairs.
Susan, what was the reaction in the room last night when Trump said that he may not accept the results of the election? We're going to hear how he said that, and we're going to hear what Hillary Clinton said in a second. But I'm curious about what those undecided voters did when they heard that.
They weren't really moved by it one way or the other. After all, the 2000 election, you know, where that occurred, all the controversy, and as you recall, Al Gore did contest the election, and so it was an issue that really didn't push these undecided voters as much as the economic and foreign policy issues did.
Wow. Let's listen to how Donald Trump put that when he was asked by Chris Wallace, the moderator, if he would accept the results of the election, no matter the outcome.
I will look at it at the time. I'm not looking at anything now. I'll look at it at the time. What I've seen is so bad. First of all, the media is so dishonest and so corrupt. And the pile-on is so amazing. The New York Times actually wrote an article about it that they don't even care. It's so dishonest, and they've poisoned the minds of the voters. But unfortunately for them, I think the voters are seeing through it. I think they're going to see through it. We'll find out on November 8th, but I think they're going to see through it.
But, sir, there's
If you look, excuse me, Chris, if you look at your voter rolls, you will see millions of people that are registered to vote. Millions. This isn't coming from me. This is coming from Pew Report and other places. Millions of people that are registered to vote that shouldn't be registered to vote.
Okay, let me take a call from a listener here, from Chad in Minneapolis. And Chad, you think that's a reasonable position on Donald Trump's part, is that right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, it'd be like, say, asking a quarterback to guarantee his acceptance of a loss handed to his team, before knowing the outcome of the game and what happens during the game. I mean, there could be widespread, you know, calls against his team, and you want him to say he's going to be accepting of that by the end of the game. And, you know, it's the same thing, and you can't really corner somebody into that position because it's the way it's supposed to go.
All right.
Who knows what's going to happen in between now and the end tally of the votes.
Christina, is the football game and quarterback analogy an appropriate one to you?
It is absolutely not an appropriate one for me. This is American democracy we're talking about. We're not talking about, you know, the Pittsburgh Steelers or the, you know, the New England Patriots. We are talking about the presidency, which is the highest office, not just in this country, but it is now an international position. And the crux of our stability as an American democracy rests on the fact that we have peaceful transitions of power and free and fair elections. We know 2000 shook us up just a little bit because free and fair elections came under attack, but we still had a peaceful transition of power. It is absolutely horrific and deplorable to think that the nominee of a major party has not fully said that he would accept the results of the will of the public. And, you know, even if Hillary Clinton sweeps the map and makes the electoral map look like 1972, where, you know, it's just, it will be blue, 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 because this is a fear of the Republicans that she will sweep in some ways, for him to say on October 19th that it'll be a surprise and we'll just have to wait and see whether or not he'll accept it, what he's actually doing is sending a dog whistle to his more radical supporters who've already said that they are real patriots and they want to take out Hillary Clinton. And so this, to me, is extremely dangerous and incendiary rhetoric for people who are gun-wielding, Confederate flag-waving, who've already said that they don't respect the legitimacy of Barack Obama and they refuse to respect the legitimacy of Hillary Clinton, and they're armed to the teeth to rid our country of people of color, immigrants, and Muslims. So for him to say that last night was not only irresponsible, but to me it was incredibly dangerous, and hopefully it will motivate people to go to the polls to make sure that he is nowhere near 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue ever.
Susan, how did you hear it?
Well, obviously the thing that caught my ear was the fact that from a strategy perspective that he was going counter to his vice presidential nominee and his chief campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, who had been out telling people that, no, we'll accept the results, that's not true, or whatever. So I think that's why so much of the discussion today in new media across the country is pointing to that as, you know, one of the worst things he did from the Republican perspective was go down that path when the message that had been sent out by his surrogates was just the opposite. So I think that from a strategy perspective is how a lot of people are looking at it.
You know, Susan and Christina, what came to my mind when I heard him say that is, well, if he isn't going to believe the results of a national election that he doesn't potentially win, why is he going to believe the results of individual state elections where Republicans may be elected statewide? I mean, you know, you begin to call into question the candidacies and the election results of a whole lot of elections, not just the national election. Christina?
But I think Donald Trump has shown us that he does not care about anyone but Donald Trump. I mean, he will burn down his own party and this country for himself. He really does not care about downstate ballots. That's why Republicans are so concerned right now, because of some of the things that he's saying and doing. They're really afraid that some Republicans will abstain and stay home just because they're really so confused. They're going to sit this out, and that's really going to hurt quite a few of their candidates. I mean, the fact that Republicans are actually worried about possibly losing seats in the House, when that wasn't a conversation a month or two ago, lets us know that they realize that having him at the top of the ticket is a real danger, because he said, you know, the other day, let's just drain the swamp. Let's just start getting rid of Republicans who don't agree with me. I mean, that, as a party, I know must make the Republicans incredibly nervous, because what Donald Trump doesn't realize is there's a lot of institutional mechanisms that occur to make a party work. It's not just about the presidential nominee of the particular party. But because he hasn't even ever been really registered as a Republican in recent memory, it's not like he has allegiance and loyalty to the party, to Reince Priebus, and definitely not to Paul Ryan, because he's in Wisconsin talking about how terrible Paul Ryan is at his own rally.
And actually, Ryan has been saying, yes, of course we will accept the results of the election. I want you both to hear an excerpt from an interview that Steve Inskeep at NPR did this morning with Republican Congressman Tom Marino of Pennsylvania. And Steve asked Marino about these specific comments that Trump made.
We should mention you were an early Trump supporter in Pennsylvania. I want to ask about his statement that he's going to tell us later if he will abide by the election results. Why is that acceptable?
I'm not saying it is acceptable. He said it in a way that it was a tease. It's Donald Trump. He says it's on his mind at the time. But that's
forgive me, the phone line is bad. Did you say it was a tease? It's Donald Trump?
Yeah, I think he came out with saying, well, this makes this a little suspenseful, and I'll tell you when I see what the results are. But the way he said it, I think he really supports the democracy, the votes, and how the determination is made by the American people.
Do you mean to say that this is just a big reality show reveal, that he's actually going to accept the results?
I think it's certainly going to accept the results.
Are you confident of that, Susan? And what do you think about what Congressman Marino is saying?
Well, obviously, if you're Republican right now, you're certainly, as we said earlier, as a surrogate on the trail in a way, you really are torn on this whole issue, which has become the dominant issue of the day. What I find a little bit disconcerting is the fact that the undecided people, as we mentioned earlier, they're really about the economy and issues. And we've talked about, and I agree with the other guests, that, you know, the issues have been missing here, that there's so much attention yet again by the media today to just this issue when there were so many other substantive things talked about. I don't give my own opinion on these issues. I'm a person who looks at the data, and I look at how people are reacting to things. But I was really stunned in a way to hear them say that this didn't matter nearly as much as, well, not stunned, but that it wasn't a big issue to these voters who are undecided in a swing state to the degree that we're talking about this endlessly today. I think that's what's frustrating a lot of voters in what they see as more of, a reality show election rather than one that's issues-based. I regard it as a personality more than a policy election.
And Susan, I have to, you know, I don't want to be dismissive of some voters, but voters right up until the day before the election will say things like, I don't know enough about where they stand on the issues. I don't know what they there is so much information out there about
right.
where these candidates stand on the issues, all for the taking, all for the reading, all for the accessing. Who are these voters that don't think they know where they stand on the issues?
Demographically, we know that they are often non-college educated. They don't read the news media or listen to news programs necessarily on television, other than local news is more preeminent in their lives. Many are blue-collar workers who are stressed job-wise and time-wise. They're not the 24/7 people who are attentive to politics. And what we say in our business are they're somewhat the casual voter who every 4 years thinks about, should I vote or am I going to vote, and if so, for whom? But we do know from previous exit polls and earlier elections that it's often, these people who are the ones who say that there hasn't been enough issue coverage in elections.
Christina, I'm going to suggest that, and I know Susan knows this, there's a lot of territory between 24/7 deeply immersed in the election and, some of these voters that are casual and don't know if they're going to vote until, you know, it's months before the presidential election. What about these people in the middle who also still say, why don't they talk to me about the economy? Why don't they talk to me? They have positions everywhere, lots of information on this. I don't understand that excuse.
Well, I think, unfortunately, you know, the data shows that people actually really start paying attention to, you know, the general public starts paying attention to elections, you know, 2, maybe 3 weeks before the election. I mean, for something so incredibly important.
It's unbelievable.
We can look at, you know, turnout rates. I mean, we're a democracy. Now, granted, we don't have, compulsory voting. We don't give people mandatory time off to vote like other democracies do. And so, you know, even with Barack Obama in 2008, which, you know, many people argued was the biggest change election we'd ever seen in our generation or in our lifetime, you know, barely 60% of the voting eligible population turned out. I mean, you know, in New York City where I am, you know, for the mayor's election, 17% of the voting eligible population turned out. So we definitely have a voter apathy problem, or some may argue a voter fatigue problem based on how often we ask members of the electorate to vote. But, you know, the information is there, but we have to remember there are costs to acquiring this information. And so for obviously highly educated people and wealthier people, those costs are dramatically decreased. We're constantly talking about elections with our friends and family members, and it's in our social networks and political networks. And we don't have to worry about, you know, transportation to and from a polling site. We can read English. You know, these are things that many people don't necessarily factor in, but they're incredibly important when it comes to the calculus of someone deciding who to vote. I mean, they're invisible boundaries. Some people are incredibly intimidated by the process, and so they choose to abstain, especially when we have two candidates whose likability ratings are the lowest we've ever seen in our generation. So, unfortunately, you know, there is some blame to be placed on the voter, but I think, you know, the way our system is set up right now is that no very few people pay attention to the primary process when there's so many people and it seems like a circus. And so you end up with two choices where many people just aren't necessarily excited or happy about, but the vast majority of Americans weren't necessarily paying attention in January and February either, when you had a selection of 17 Republicans and 5 Democrats.
Christina Greer with us today from Fordham, and Susan McManus with us from the University of South Florida. As we take stock of some of what was said in the debate last night between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and then some of the larger issues that are animating the conversation around the campaign, I'm asking you about a particular moment that, as Susan points out, has gotten a lot of attention this morning. We've also pulled some of the excerpts about some of the issues as were debated last night. But I'm interested in, given what Donald Trump said last night about his ambivalence about accepting the results of the election if he doesn't win. Here's what I want to know from you. Do you think you'll be capable, if your candidate doesn't win, doesn't prevail, in putting some of the bitterness and the rancor of this political discussion behind you? Can you give the new president, whoever it is, the benefit of the doubt, at least for a few months? Do a little soul searching here. Don't just call me with an immediate, "Of course I can." I really want you to touch base on this and then join the conversation. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R, to Amber in northwestern Minnesota. Hi, Amber. Thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while.
No problem. So you touched on how this has become a personality versus an issue campaign, and it's really, we need to look at the campaigns. This is the largest national job interview we have, mm-hmm. really. And if I can't imagine going into a job interview and being asked questions and not answering the question I've been asked, but instead giving talking points and then criticizing whoever I'm up against the job for. And that's what our debates have been. And our moderators have tried to interrupt and can't, and they've just been interrupting, and there has been no civility. My candidate isn't going to win because I'm voting third party. I will not vote for either Hillary nor Trump mm-hmm. At this point, because I have children, and I don't want my children acting that way, and so I'm not going to vote for somebody that I wouldn't. That I wouldn't want my children to grow up emulating.
Okay.
If that
Amber,
makes sense.
It does. Amber, I'm going to pick up on what you said about the job interview, though. I think that's a good point. And Susan, do you look at these ever-lengthening campaigns and then the series of debates as a good method in that job interview idea?
Increasingly not so much so, even though there's been tremendous interest in the debates, especially the first one. The problem is related also to the voting process. Many people have already voted or have gotten their ballots or whatever else, actually voted, and we just now had the third debate. But the extended campaign is really creating a lot of voter fatigue. But the most important thing, and your caller is absolutely on point, people who really want to know the answers to the questions are very, very frustrated. We heard that over and over and over again last night with the focus group. But the second thing is, and related to the caller's point about children and tone and whatever, the lack of civility. Before we even began the evening, we asked people, what was their number one concern about this election? Hands down, it was the lack of civility and the negativity. There's even a game around town that asks, how long would it take them to bash each other? How many seconds into the debate? I mean, we have some of those kind of contests. This is what is so frustrating. People who really want to know, okay, he asked you, what are you going to do about Iraq?
Mm-hmm.
They went all over the map on that question. That was very frustrating to people. And that's the problem, is that these formats are entertainment more than they're informative,
Well, I expect...
And that's frustrating to people who don't really tune in to hear the bashing of each other.
Susan, I expect Chris Wallace or the moderators to hold them to the issue, and I don't know why they can't.
In a way, it's They can't because they let them talk over each other and extend beyond the time limits. I've been in many a newsroom lately where the suggestion was, why don't you have it so that you can cut off their mic if they go over or they don't answer the question?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I hear a lot of people say, and I think the public is ready for that kind of thing. They are really very tired. And asking somebody to tune in for an hour and a half, be really curious to see what percentage of those who tune in, how far into the debate they go, and how many actually end, you know, up watching the whole thing. You really have tremendous fall off.
Christina, I want to play one of the issues, and this is actually where Chris Wallace began last night with a question about the U.S. Supreme Court. And then I want to hear from both of you about here's a good issue debate. What did we learn about where Trump and Clinton stand on a Supreme Court appointment, which is something that they're going to have to make early on in their term? So this is Hillary Clinton first on that question.
We need a Supreme Court that will stand up on behalf of women's rights, on behalf of the rights of the LGBT community, that will stand up and say no to Citizens United, a decision that has undermined the election system in our country because of the way it permits dark, unaccountable money to come into our electoral system. I have major disagreements with my opponent about these issues and others that will be before the Supreme Court.
And that's Hillary Clinton. And here is Donald Trump on who he would be thinking about to appoint to the U.S. Supreme Court.
We need a Supreme Court that, in my opinion, is going to uphold the Second Amendment and all amendments, but the Second Amendment, which is under absolute siege. I feel that the justices that I am going to appoint, and I've named 20 of them, the justices that I'm going to appoint will be pro-life. They will have a conservative bent. They will be protecting the Second Amendment. They are great scholars in all cases, and they are people of tremendous respect.
Okay, Christina, that sounded pretty civil. What did we learn?
Well, I think Secretary Clinton made a very clear case for women that she would be the pro-choice president, and she would elect or nominate, she would nominate to the Senate for confirmation pro-choice justices. As far as money and politics and Citizens United, you know, that's obviously a Democratic issue. That's something that Bernie Sanders has been trying to pull her to the left on. I think some people, you know, who feel that she's not necessarily honest will look at her and say, but, you know, you are friends with people on Wall Street, so how will you negotiate that? You know, keep in mind, the beauty and the curse of American democracy is that, you know, we have checks and balances. We have the separation of powers. That's what Federalist 51 is all about. I think she fundamentally understands the Constitution and the ways in which the presidency, Congress, and the Supreme Court have to work together. I'm not certain that Donald Trump understands that. I mean, the Second Amendment is actually not under siege. You know, there is nothing on the books, actually, unfortunately, that says that we actually should have stricter gun regulation. And so, you know, what he's doing, again, is sending a dog whistle to his supporters to say, just like Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton is trying to take away your guns. Barack Obama is not taking away guns. We've seen how many shootings we've had on a daily basis since he became president of children. I think that was the argument that Hillary Clinton was trying to make. There's a difference between going hunting with your parents and your family members and having an AK-47 and being able to walk into a preschool. As far as being pro-life, I think it's very interesting because that's a new position for Donald Trump. But unfortunately, with this conversation, it's oftentimes pro-choice versus pro-life,
right,
which is not the constitutional conversation we're having.
Exactly.
It's pro-choice versus anti-choice. And I think Hillary Clinton was trying to, you know, without getting too in the weeds and becoming a lawyer and sort of John Kerry-esque, was trying to make the argument that what she's fighting for is a woman's right to decide whether or not she would engage in this very personal, intimate, and difficult decision with her family, clergy, and whomever else, and it is not the government's decision to do that. So I do wish that she would have corrected him, because the language of pro-life is really misleading, because there are several people who are pro-choice who would never actually have an abortion, but they like to know that the option is available for the millions of women, 51% of the country, who reside here.
Okay, so Susan, did you learn more about what Clinton and Trump would be looking for in an appointee, or did you learn more about the issues that Christina just pulled out?
I think she did a great job of describing the whole situation, but it really does boil down to the age-old difference, and that is strict constructionist views of the Constitution versus, you know, more interpretive views of the document, and these two candidates reflected those differences.
To the phones to Janet in St. Paul. Hi, Janet. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hello.
Hi.
Trump's contention that the election is rigged because ineligible people are voting has been a brilliant move on his part to shift media attention away from the real problem, which is voter suppression via restrictive voter IDs and all sorts of other things that tend to suppress the votes of persons of colors, lower income persons, many of whom would probably vote Democratic. This is the first election without the protection of the Voting Rights Act, and if anything tends to invalidate the election in my mind, it's voter suppression.
Janet, we've had a couple of shows on that, and we have another conversation planned before Election Day to check in on what's happening with these voter ID laws. But I'd like to put that question to you, too, Susan, and add this from Mark on Twitter. We have a new all-time high in registered voters. Are there really millions of people, unqualified registered voters out there? Can you answer that?
I can't answer the question about how many there are, things of that nature. I will say that what you've seen this election cycle is a number of court decisions where restrictive kinds of prohibitions about voting and IDs have, the courts have intervened. In Florida, we have a very liberal voter ID law, so we have not faced that, but we recently had a court ruling about extending the registration period because of the storm, things of that nature. There are problem areas for voting laws. There's absolutely differences across the states. There's no uniformity in election laws. I think that is what's often very frustrating. But every election cycle, we do hear incidences of people voting in two states, especially we see that with, you know, people in Florida and who have residences elsewhere. And you have the most problem in, if there's fraud, it's in the absentee balloting process. We've had some incidences in Miami. A former Congress member's aide was convicted of mass absentee ballot fraud. But to the degree of predicting millions fraudulently registered, I would be a little bit doubtful of that.
Christina, what would you say about that?
I mean, I think the caller is absolutely correct. This is the first time that we are going to the polls in 50 years without the full protection of the VRA, which is very frightening. I also think that, you know, we don't have a fraud problem. That is a myth that's created by Republicans as a boogeyman, and it's been helpful for Donald Trump because he's essentially trying to justify his loss by saying they've already stolen it from me, and also to galvanize his supporters to go to particular communities with their open carry laws to try and intimidate voters. And we've seen intimidation of voters on a host of levels over the years, but this is the first time where we've ever had a presidential candidate who's actually calling on his supporters to take arms and go to polls to, quote-unquote, monitor the situations for those Barack Obama people, code word for African Americans, or as Donald Trump would say, the blacks. So, I think we have entered what I pray is not a new normal. You know, as we've seen the presidency expand over the years, and very rarely has it ever contracted, I do think that, you know, I hope that for this particular election season, we've seen, you know, style over substance, reality TV over policy discussions, but I really do hope that by 2020, we've gotten it out of our systems and we're back to trying at least to discuss issues. I mean, if we think back in 2012, one of the worst things that was said was Mitt Romney's offhanded comment about binders full of women.
That was
the most, you know,
which is like mild. That's nothing compared to this.
Nothing.
It's
that
true.
Is, you know, just the, it seemed like a huge deal. Women win as binders for Halloween, you know, and this year we have conversations where, you know, parents are afraid to even let their children watch a debate if a 10-year-old's interested in being a part of the political process. As a professor, I'm trying to get more students voting, thinking about running for office, and really excited about, you know, for many of them, it's their very first time voting. And it should be special, and it should be something that they think about. And, you know, I have to say, I have lots of students who will abstain, and I've tried my best to get them to think about all of the reasons why they should vote, you know, not just historical reasons, but, you know, the game is going to be played, so you might want to pick a team, even though it's not the most optimal team, whatever the case may be, and they are just so turned off. And I really also hope that the media does a postmortem to see where they've been complicit in the shenanigans.
Definitely.
And really the dumbing down of the most important office in the country.
You mentioned Halloween, and I have a tweet here from Annie Lowry, who's a reporter in D.C., who says there's going to be bad hombres and nasty women couples costumes on Halloween. You're listening to a conversation this morning about some of the things that came up in the debate, some of the things that we're chuckling about, and then some of the issue conversation. And then we have not talked about, I think, one of the more anticipated moments of the debate, which is what would Chris Wallace ask Donald Trump about these allegations of from nine women about groping and assault and coercion, and what would Hillary Clinton say about that? So on the other side of news, we'll talk about that. I'm interested in your view on how Donald Trump explained that. What you heard as he pointed out, as he did last night in the debate, that no one respects women more than he does. There's been some interesting focus group reaction on that. We'll talk about that. Christine Greer with us from Fordham. Susan McManus continues with us from the University of South Florida, and to the newsroom now with John Wanamaker. Hi, John.
Hi, Carrie. Donald Trump is catching heat from both supporters and critics over his refusal during last night's debate to say that he would accept the outcome of next month's election. Hillary Clinton's running mate Tim Kaine told MSNBC that Trump is trying to pull the central pillar down, referring to the tradition of the losing candidate peacefully stepping aside. Conservative commentator Laura Ingraham, who backs Trump, says he should have said he would accept the result. Meanwhile, the Republican National Committee says the party will respect the will of the people. A UN aid official for Syria says Russia has agreed to extend daily pauses in military action against rebel-held eastern Aleppo for four more days. Jan Englund has told the Associated Press that the UN today received verbal assurances from the extension both from Russia's diplomatic mission in Geneva and in writing from Russian military officials in Syria. He says the UN hopes to begin medical evacuations during a pause in fighting tomorrow. France's foreign minister is warning that up to 1 million people might try to flee the fighting in the Iraqi city of Mosul. Iraqi special forces are preparing to enter the city. The French official says authorities must check each one of them to make sure Islamic State extremists are not escaping among the civilians. France is part of the U.S.-led military coalition helping with the Iraqi operation aimed at retaking the city from the Islamic State group. Stocks are slightly lower on Wall Street after several companies released disappointing results or forecasts. Verizon down 2.5% after reporting weak revenue and subscriber growth. eBay is off over 6% after releasing weak forecasts, and that is reflected definitely in the NASDAQ. The NASDAQ off 0.5% right now. The Dow and the S&P 500 off over around 0.33%. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
The new investigative podcast from APM Reports is getting great reviews. The Guardian calls it gripping. The Columbia Journalism Review says it's enthralling. And Vox says it's better than Serial. Download In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
We started our What It Means to Be an American series yesterday with an interview with Roseanne Cash. Today, Mexican-American writer Luis Urrea on that question. You'll be able to find all of the conversations on what it means to be an American on my podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this program comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.
Back to the conversation now this hour about the debate. And one of the moments we have not yet talked about is how Donald Trump answered a question from moderator Chris Wallace about these allegations from women of groping and assault and sexual coercion, and then what Hillary Clinton had to say about that. So I want to play first Chris Wallace and Donald Trump on this, and then we'll hear from Hillary Clinton.
Mr. Trump, at the last debate, you said your talk about grabbing women was just that, talk, and that you'd never actually done it. And since then, as we all know, 9 women have come forward and said that you either groped them or kissed them without their consent. Why would so many different women from so many different circumstances over so many different years, why would they all in this last couple of weeks make up, you deny this, why would they all make up these stories? And since this is a question for both of you, Secretary Clinton, Mr. Trump says what your husband did and that you defended was even worse. Mr. Trump, you go first.
Well, first of all, those stories have been largely debunked. Those people, I don't know those people. I have a feeling how they came. I believe it was her campaign that did it. Just like if you look at what came out today on the clips, where I was wondering what happened with my rally in Chicago and other rallies where we had such violence. She's the one in Obama that caused the violence.
He held a number of big rallies where he said that he could not possibly have done those things to those women because they were not attractive enough for
I did not say that. I did not say that.
In fact, he went on to say...
Her two minutes, sir.
But he did not say that.
It's her 2 minutes.
He went on to say, look at her. I don't think so. About another woman, he said, that wouldn't be my first choice. He attacked the woman reporter writing the story, called her disgusting, as he has called a number of women during this campaign. You know, Donald thinks belittling women makes him bigger. He goes after their dignity, their self-worth, and I don't think there is a woman anywhere who doesn't know what that feels like.
So, Susan, I thought Chris Wallace's question was well positioned, but then he didn't really follow up on it when Trump wandered around and never really came back to the core of the question. What did you hear?
Similar, but I don't think that coming back to it would have yielded any different answer. And to the people that I was watching, the strongest portion of Hillary Clinton's performance was on every issue related to women and women's rights.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that Wallace, I'm not speaking for him, probably expected that she would really drill down on that, which she obviously did very effectively.
Christina, what did you hear in that?
Well, I mean, I agree with Susan. I mean, Hillary Clinton clearly was prepared for that question, and I think she picked up where Carly Fiorina left off in the primary when Donald Trump had said something about Carly Fiorina's looks by basically saying, look at her, you know, she couldn't be president, look at that face.
Right.
And Carly Fiorina said, you know, Donald, I think we all heard what you said, and sending out her own silent dog whistle to women everywhere to say this is the type of man who judges women by their looks. I mean, I think the fascinating thing with Donald Trump is because he lacks intellectual discipline, he says women love him, he says he's never done these things, and then before the night is over, he says such a nasty woman in a way that's so visceral, it completely made Hillary Clinton's point. And I think because of her debate prep, I'm curious to see the types of ads that will come out in the subsequent days and weeks, because she systematically poked the bear the entire evening and made him deny things that he has said on camera. And so I think it'll be easier for her to put out some negative ads closer to November 8th, where he's essentially blatantly lying about things that he actually has said.
So you see ads that go, he said this and then he said that.
The ads that she's put out in the past where it's like, you know, I said that he said this. No, I didn't. And then you show that he essentially said it. The same way they put out with Pence, where, you know, many people argue that Kane did a terrible job during the vice presidential debate, which I think Pence, you know, came off as a much stronger candidate, as if anyone's really watching the vice presidential debate.
But well, for those I of us was.
Were, you know, but the issue is Kane did what he was sent to do, which was to get Pence to deny things that have been said on camera. And in the digital age that we live in, all you have to do is upload it. They had an attack ad ready in less than 3 hours. So I think the campaign wanted to walk Trump into a particular little honey traps where he blatantly denied saying particular things that at this point many of us have already seen him say it several times.
Call here from Yusuf in Burnsville. Hey, good morning, Yusuf, and thanks so much for waiting.
Thank you. Good morning, guys. I know I'm a longtime registered Republican, and I have about 10 friends, and we've been wondering, like, when is this guy going to just maybe start taking ownership on the mistake that he has made as a human being? And after last night, me and 10 of my friends, we just threw our hands up and say, you know what, we're going to vote for Hillary for the first time ever. I'm going to vote for a Democrat.
How's that going to feel, Yusuf?
You know, honestly, it'll feel good because for the first, I'm justified to vote for a Democrat because I'm blaming the Republican Party committee for allowing somebody whose ego is more bigger than, and he's just letting his ego run pretty much everything. And I just don't understand why Republican Party won't step in and do anything about it. And I was a big Rubio supporter, and it's heartbreaking to have somebody who's running for president stand on the national TV, and the whole world is watching, and he's speaking like that. It just breaks your heart.
Yusuf, you've brought up a really good point that I wanted to raise with our guests here, so thank you very much for the call. Susan, I think you and Christina mentioned earlier that there's going to be a lot of soul searching after the election. The media has a role in that. You know, the GOP went through this in 2012. They did the famous autopsy and came out with Reince Priebus, came out with a list of recommendations. And it all kind of fell apart once we got into the presidential primary. What might be different this time if Trump loses? Susan?
Well, particularly if not only he loses, but others lose, which would mean, for example, the switch of the U.S. Senate back to the Democratic column. That would be earth-shattering. A lot of Republicans are already on edge about the down-ballot races, as Christina mentioned earlier. But what I think is going to be very apparent if it turns out like the polls are showing right now is the idea that you can ignore demographics of this country in key swing states is just a ridiculous assumption. It is precisely why Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio in our state have repeatedly warned, starting way even before 2012, the party about dissing Hispanics, which are one of the fastest growing demographic groups in our state when we're a large swing state. So at the end of the day, if Republicans lose other races other than the presidency and it becomes more pervasive, a structural issue for the party, you probably will see some new kinds of party rules being put in place about candidacies and positions and so forth.
You know what's
but there's nothing to stop anybody from running for president.
Exactly.
Anyone can.
I was just going to say that, Christina. You know what's interesting about that is Susan's suggesting more party rules, trying to, you know, lay more discipline over on the process. But you really, I mean, if the primary season that we went through is a good example of how it is almost impossible to control that.
Right. And I mean, the way the system is set up is, you know, the voters decided. I mean, granted, only 33% of Republican voters decided Donald Trump. But, you know, that's Reince Priebus's fault. You know, if you are the head of the Republican Party, your job is to work towards the strength of the party. He should have had conversations with some of the 17 candidates and said, this man does not represent our interests. He will be dangerous down the road, but also down ballot. Some of you need to step aside so that we can have a more substantive, robust series of debates. It's 11 debates.
So wait a minute. So you think the reason that Trump ended up where he is because it was so splintered and there were too many candidates in the primary?
Indeed.
But that's
American democracy. They're allowed to stay, but I'm also not Reince Priebus, right? And so if I care about my party and essentially a Democratic interloper who is the only 21st century candidate in a race who understands the media in a way that no presidential candidate has ever understood the media before and is already connected with, you know, a large portion of our demographic vis-a-vis reality television, I would say that, you know, just because you all are interested in running this time around, maybe it's not the best time because he's only getting 30%. But the rest of the 70% is being splintered between 16 other people. And so Donald Trump was only talking on stage for about 12 to 17 minutes for the vast majority of all the debates. So people never really got to hear any of his ideas because he never really had to stand up there and defend them against one person.
But Susan, I think Priebus and other Republican leaders tried to do that, didn't they?
The candidates wouldn't listen. It isn't because, you know, it's rare that you have a non-incumbent, only every 8 years if it's a two-term president, that you have an open seat. And anybody that had pent up, gold of wanting to be president just jumped into that race. And, you know, that's what happens with this kind of thing. But, you know, we haven't talked about something that I think is really important, and that is the fact that there are a lot of people that are really disgusted with the two major parties. And one of the things that came up in our group last night was one voter had gotten his absentee ballot, and he says, I didn't even know there were other party candidates on the ballot. The fixation of the media on just these two candidates and the threshold that was set up for getting the Libertarian and the Green Party candidate onto the debate stage was so high. And among millennials, which Christina talked about, I teach them also, one-third of the millennials in Florida are registered as no party affiliation. Mm-hmm. And they don't like the two major candidates because they don't like the two-party system as it is right now for a lot of different reasons. But in looking ahead, ignoring interesting third and, you know, minor party candidates, look at where Bernie Sanders got the attention of the younger voters. And the big question mark now, which Christina has evidenced what we see in here, not as much interest in the whole election system among this younger generation, which is now America's largest generation. And even in Florida, 26% of our registered voters are 18 to 34 years of age. And when you add that to that, the Gen Xers a little bit older than them, the two youngest generations make up half of our registrants. And yet the politics has not adjusted to this monumental shift in the age composition of this country.
Susan, really good to have you on the show. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I also want to note that we have had invitations out to the candidates, the nominees for the third parties for months now and have not had our invitation accepted. So we were interested in hearing what they had to say. Christina, thanks very much. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Just want to add this here as we close this conversation. I heard from a lot of you after the show on Monday morning at 9 o'clock about sexual assault, coercion, harassment, and of course, coming off this situation with the tapes and the allegations against Donald Trump. I'm going to read one letter from a listener named Stephanie who said, I'm listening to your show this morning. I've suddenly begun to shake. It must be an emotional reaction about this topic. I was groped by a male stranger on a very crowded city bus in my 20s. I just completed a self-defense class, and I remember what my instructor told me. I turned and faced the groper and yelled at the top of my lungs while pointing at him, "This man is touching me." What happened next was not what I expected. The bus driver immediately pulled over, and several men grabbed the creep and roughly threw him off the bus. No one really said anything to me that I can remember, but what I took from this was not that all men are potential creeps, but that most men hate that reputation and are really good men. She goes on to say, I have a 14-year-old daughter, and I think the pain I'm feeling is from understanding how vulnerable she is. This is a wake-up call for me to hear the conversation today because it's not a matter of if something will happen to her. It's a matter of when. And I want her to use her voice and call these men out for all to see. You can reach me via email, kmiller@npr.org. You can tweet me, @KerryNPR.